Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. I have two guests on two different topics today. My first guest is Kevin Skerritt. Kevin is a pensions researcher at the Canadian Union of Public Employees, and I spoke with him about the role of pensions in financialized capitalism. Don't let the word pensions scare you off. This is a conversation that gets to the heart of how workers relate to the market and each other, as well as the role of labor unions in a changing neoliberal economy. From pensions, I move to privatization with my second guest, Sheila Block. Sheila is the senior economist at the Ontario office of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and we talked about the impending privatization of Hydro One in Ontario, a cynical and financially senseless sell-off of an important public asset. Well, why don't we start with just with the basics? What does the pension system look like in Canada right now? What's a sort of a very quick rundown?
So I describe the system that we have in Canada, and in many ways it's closely modeled and evolved out of the U.S. system. So I often talk about a North American system where we have, unlike the systems that evolved in Western Europe, we have a retirement income system and pension system that is kind of underpinned by a public component. And in Canada, that's established by the old age security system, which is federal income tax funded, and the Canada Pension Plan, which is funded by, you know, work-based premiums, earning-based premiums paid by workers and employers. But those two public plans are really minimal. They are really for a lot of people, this is providing only the most basic income. It can really, in combination, the most income you can derive from those programs now is $18,000 to $19,000 a year. So over the post-war period, a lot of trade unions and others fought to establish workplace-based supplemental plans. So what we think of as pension plans in the workplace, that for those of us who have them, forms really the largest part of retirement income. But the reality is that two-thirds of Canadian workers or more don't have access to a workplace plan like that. It really is a minority, and in fact a shrinking minority because of the attacks on workplace plans. So we end up with an awkward public-private system where the employers have kind of pulled out or are in the process of pulling out of their part of the bargain and wanting to shove people onto their own independent means, or the public system, which has always been deeply inadequate, and now under the Harper government in particular is also under attack as well. So we've got a really troubled system.
And what have the changes been most recently? I mean, I think we've seen the rise of RSPs and other sort of individual vehicles like that. And where are these changes going again, sort of briefly?
Yeah, so I would say, I mean, even in the very recent period of the last few years, people may be familiar that the federal Harper government in 2012 launched a major initiative by proposing to, and in fact implementing legislation to change the age of eligibility for old age security, OAS, from age 65, the long established age parameter, up to age 67. Which really just removes a chunk of money from future retirees worth about $6,500 a year in today's dollars, so $13,000-$14,000 over 2 years from everyone. It's almost like an expropriation, a really dramatic step backward in the fight for a decent pension system. But that's part of a pattern of trimming the CPP benefits in the late 90s, federal government and employers pushing private individual schemes, like you mentioned, RRSPs, and now we have TFSAs, the tax-free savings accounts, all of these various sort of alphabet soup of federal programs, which are essentially tax cuts or tax deferral systems to encourage and incentivize people to save and invest for themselves, which, of course, the data shows us that the vast majority of people and workers don't do. It's only the highest income earners that are able to take advantage of these sorts of schemes.
So I wanted to get to a point that I think comes out in your research around pensions, and I think a lot of the other stuff is that, and for me as well, I think one of the more interesting aspects of the post-war era, and especially the most recent sort of the last few decades, has been how workers, you know, and have become, as these public systems are trimmed back, as you say, workers become more and more implicated in sort of capitalist finance on the other hand. I mean, housing is certainly one way this is done, but also pensions, I think, are an important component of this. How has the evolution of the pension system made workers more dependent sort of on healthy financial markets and, you know, made them more reliant on, you know, on stock market gains and all that?
Well, I think that for me, this is one of the kind of fascinating questions, and because it's a combination of a historical one and kind of a political one. Because, as you say, what we're seeing is more and more workers drawn into the financial system, particularly through these, specifically these individual investment schemes. But there's also other parts of our lives that are getting kind of financialized, whether it's student loans or housing loans or credit cards and car loans. And so both on the saving and investment end of things and also the borrowing end, we're getting, you know, ever more deeply implicated into these systems. And I would say that, you know, the way I think about this, I've been interested in the historical evolution of this. This is a very different picture today in 2015 compared to, as you say, the time of the early post-war period or certainly pre-Second World War. When this just wasn't the case, people lived a much more cash economy, and it was, you know, a very different social system, and the, you know, the impact of the welfare state, it was very significant. And I would say that through the course of the post-war decades, various changes and evolutions, particularly in this North American system and the retirement system, pensions, got workers drawn into kind of contact with and an awareness of the stock market and the financial markets and the securities markets in an entirely different way. And I'm not saying there's some who characterize this as a sort of democratization of finance and, you know, like the spreading of the good things of owning the stake of financial capital very broadly. I don't see that at all. When you look at the data, you realize that even when you have little small stakeholdings and little RSP accounts, the vast bulk of financial profits and surpluses are still channeled into very few, in fact, fewer and fewer pockets. But nonetheless, I'd say through these different mechanisms, in particular through pension funds and mutual funds and RSP-style systems, I think we have been kind of drawn into a framework of identifying our economic livelihood and particularly our future life and our retirement security getting associated with the health and the continuing function of the private financial markets and the securities markets. So, you know, we've got people, you know, watching the ups and downs of the Toronto Stock Exchange or even international financial flows, and having their economic and even their political consciousness kind of shaped by those, you know, fluctuations, you know, and it's got our thinking, I think, directed far from where we really have our kind of political power and our social power, which is based more in our collective identity, either as workers or as citizens or in, you know, various other ways.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I and maybe the flip side of that is that then we actually have some pension funds actually participating in privatizations, right, because of this search for yield and a search for good returns. But you see them implicated sometimes in pushes for privatization. I'll be talking with Sheila Block later about the, you know, impending privatization of Hydro One, and we've seen other things before. Is this another way that then this turn towards the financial markets also at the same time undermines some of the other public assets and public programs that are already in existence?
Well, I think that's right. And for me, I mean, I work for CUPE, Public Sector Union, that is sort of known for, you know, doing whatever we can to defend the public sector and to fight off the privatization and the various forms of commercializing public services. And so there's, for me, there's been this painful irony to watch as workers' pension funds, including some of the pension funds of our own members, public sector workers' pension funds, becoming a leading force in the move to channel more and more retirement savings, or, you know, more and more of the financial pools that get collected in pension funds, into projects and companies and initiatives that are structured to actually privatize parts of the public sector, or to capitalize and invest in services and assets that should be publicly owned and publicly managed. So, you know, some of this started in the early days with, like, the Highway 407 in Ontario, and there was a number of smaller projects around things like public-private partnership schools and some other things. But in the last 20 years, this has just exploded into, like, the entire public sector is now being re-engineered and restructured to move into private ownership and private management. And it's significantly pension funds that are scooping up these assets, these newly privatized assets, and because they see them as a terrific, long-term, highly profitable, and in fact, low-risk investment opportunity. And so I'm, you know, troubled by that in substance, just in its own right. But I, of course, I'm also troubled by this, you know, contradictory relationship that we end up seeing between, you know, public sector workers whose lives and jobs depend on the continuing health of the public sector, but their retirement income is getting hooked and attached to a commodification and a privatization of that same public sector, or maybe other parts of the public sector, not just in Canada, but globally. So I think this is a contradictory set of dynamics that we really want to examine and figure out how to challenge.
Yeah, and these projects are not actually being, you know, even though they're owned by pension funds, they're still being run, you know, as they would be if they were owned by just a collection of wealthy individuals or what have you, right? There's no real change in management or management style or the way.
No, that's quite right. And in fact, in a disturbing way, what we're seeing, like, this is taking new and different forms. What we're seeing is some pension funds are actually establishing subsidiary corporations that they own completely, but operate themselves as owner-operators of public infrastructure, of private companies, and they essentially become private corporate operators that simply happen to be tax-exempt because they are owned by a pension fund. They don't have to pay taxes. And so they become actually a kind of a specially competitive operator in the private markets that are, in fact, more competitive than a traditional private operator. Some other parts of the private sector will sometimes complain bitterly about what a competitive advantage that pension funds and their sort of subsidiary corporations have over them. And some of these pension funds and pension fund companies are themselves becoming political operators. They are, you know, involved in lobbying of politicians. They're involved in putting together piles of money in think tanks and lobby groups to actually press for more privatization. They're actually intervening in the public policy process. So it's very different than 30 years ago when pension funds were sort of passive investors. They would just kind of go to the secondary markets and buy bonds and stocks and sit on them and capture dividends. This world we have in 2015 is very different.
Is it actually possible to disconnect pension funds even solely from this model of finance? Or, you know, in a smaller version of this question, how can we link campaigns to save private pensions on the one hand with a sort of defense of a public pension system and perhaps an expanded one that's actually socialized?
Yeah, now this is, I think, the really crucial question. And it's not I don't think it's an easy, straightforward question. I have my own sort of initial thoughts and sets of answers to that, but I think it's one we really want to discuss and debate. I mean, I would connect what we're talking about to other processes, other evolutions that we're seeing in the financial system, what some academics are calling the financialization of the economy, of the whole private sector, where where not only are financial institutions becoming even more dominant as a sector, but non-financial enterprises and institutions are becoming financialized themselves and being drawn into financial processes. And this is itself having, I think, troubling and destabilizing effects on the economy. So I would want to connect that to what we're talking about. And so your question is, you know, are there ways to challenge this? I think we have to, and I think the only way to do that, both as workers needing, you know, retirement incomes and pensions and these kinds of securities, but also just seeing what is going on with the new power structure of our economic systems, both kind of at a national level and globally. We've got to figure out how to sort of take some controls, take some democratic control back. Now here's the other hook though. In the past, I think a lot of labor movement activists and people that took up pension questions, they had a feeling, they had an ambition that, well, if we could get joint control or trade union seats on boards that oversee these plans, well, maybe we could have bring a labor agenda to bear around an investment policy table or even around the table of, you know, corporate decision making in an indirect way. And that's an argument that I am not at all persuaded by. I think we're seeing the limits, certainly serious limits with those strategies. And I think what we want to do is, as you started to say, we need to envision a way to sort of decouple our retirement income system from this increasingly predatory financial system and reorient it to one that's public, a public system that can be democratically controlled and be organized to meet social needs rather than just be organized to maximize profits in whatever way becomes available. But that's going to be a tall order, because what it would mean is a huge expansion of some of our public systems like CPP or old age security, probably require a certain level of taxation that would go against the grain of current policy standards, and it would probably mean phasing out in some reasonable way our connections and attachments to these private welfare systems, these private pension systems, these individual RSP schemes. And that's a politically difficult prospect, because a lot of people, you know, become attached to these things, and they feel that's their only way to establish some economic security. And you know, I think that's something that we're probably going to have to overcome, because if you look at the record, you look at the data, this existing system is certainly not working for most workers, and the wealthiest sectors of the population, the proverbial 1%, are making out like bandits from this system, and this something's got to turn this around.
That was Kevin Skerritt, pensions researcher at QP, talking about pensions in financialized capitalism. Next up, Sheila Block on the privatization of Hydro One in Ontario. Well, why don't we start with the government's plan, with Ontario's plan for privatizing Hydro One. What is their plan, and how do they plan to go about this?
So what the provincial government did was it appointed a panel, which was led by the former TD Bank CEO, Ed Clark. And somewhat unsurprisingly, the result of that review of a bunch of government assets was a suggestion to privatize them, even though the mandate was quite clear that it was about kind of getting maximum value out of them rather than privatization. And so the plan specifically for Ontario Hydro was to take one portion, which is called Hydro One. There was a failed privatization experiment the last time we had a Tory government here, which resulted in the former government-owned Hydro being split up. So Hydro One does the transmission of electricity and the distribution of it. So the transmission are those big transmission lines, and distribution is how it gets to our individual houses, but not actually the power production. So Hydro One is what's being considered to be privatized. And what they're suggesting is that, and what the government has accepted, is to hive off a portion of the distribution of it and sell that off completely. And then for what remains of Hydro One, they're talking about privatizing 60% of it and doing that through what's called an IPO or initial public offering, which is selling off shares.
So then the government keeps a portion of the shares, but doesn't even have a majority stake in this leftover bit.
Absolutely. And so what happens of this smaller entity, the government will maintain 40%. And the government's trying to kind of give two messages. It's trying to give a message to the broader public that's saying we are protecting this asset and we will be remain the largest shareholder on the one hand, and on the other hand to the financial community, who they're hoping to get a lot of interest and bring a lot of money in, they're saying, the majority will be sold off and will be in private hands. And also they have switched out the chair of the board, who is a former politician, Sandra Pupatello, and they've replaced her with the former chair of the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board. So they're sending one message to Bay Street, which is, this is a serious privatization and we will remove government from decision-making powers on this, on Hydro One, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, what they're saying to kind of the residents of Ontario is not to worry, we will still have a kind of large role in the running. And they're really two very separate kind of narratives that are happening at the same time.
Right. And is part of the motivation behind this, I mean, the way it's being sold is that this is a sort of money-raising tactic. And if that's the case, I mean, aren't interest rates at sort of record lows today? It seems like a transaction like this makes little sense just at the dollars and cents financial level. And I think you've pointed that out.
So absolutely. At the dollars and cents financial level, what this government that was elected on a progressive agenda just about a year ago said was that the reason that they are selling Hydro One is to use the money to invest in transit. And I think in BC and in Vancouver, you're having another kind of public policy discussion about it as well at this time. And so it's being characterized rather than a privatization as an asset swap. And so the idea is that you're swapping these hydro assets for assets in public transit.
Seems like a bit of a cynical ploy there, right? We need to sell off one thing in order to get you another.
Absolutely. And it's a false choice because the governments obviously have a number of other choices. And as you mentioned, borrowing rates are really at historic lows, and there is a huge appetite for Ontario bonds because they're safe, they're guaranteed by the Crown, and they're really at very low interest rates. So really, there is a venue open to government to do this kind of borrowing. But really, more importantly, the conversation that the government is really avoiding is the fact that what absolutely needs to happen is they need to raise revenues to pay for a number of things, including infrastructure investment. We have a 20-year legacy in Ontario of tax cuts, again, going back to our last conservative and kind of neoliberal conservative government. And we have a very reduced fiscal capacity, and it's so reduced that even the Globe and Mail economics reporter said that this budget was an opportunity for Premier Wynne to actually raise revenues and increase taxes because per capita spending in Ontario is so low. So really there is a pretty broad consensus out there that what should have happened was raising some revenues, at least to pay for this infrastructure. And what we instead saw was selling off an asset that is really a sleight of hand, because that asset provides a continuous stream of income to the government, and you're selling it off and losing that stream of payments that the government had previously received as the only shareholder.
Right. What kind of sums does Hydro return to the province?
So Hydro has revenues of about $800 million a year. Now, much of that gets kind of plowed back into the electricity sector. And it provides revenues of around $500 million, you know, sort of close to $500 million recently, kind of averaged over the last 3 years to the province. In terms of total government financing, that isn't a huge amount of money, but it's important, and it also, so you have the loss of those dividend payments, and you also have a loss because as a Crown corporation, Ontario Hydro doesn't have to pay federal corporate income taxes. And once it becomes privatized, it will have to. So again, this might not be popular for people who are listening in Vancouver, but Ontario the Ontario government has often said that in terms of access to employment insurance and in terms of a number of other equalization programs, we really get the short end of the stick from the federal government. So voluntarily giving up these kinds of revenues to the federal government seems doubly foolish.
And also it seems like part of this choice between hydro and transit, seems like in general the market isn't undertaking any large-scale investment overall, and especially green investment. So it seems like both, you know, whether it's hydro or transit, you need a public mover for both of those.
Absolutely, that you need, and they both have important functions. And so Ontario Hydro has been a really important avenue for public policy in Ontario, and it hasn't always been successful. They have supported a green energy program that has definitely had its flaws and had its kind of missteps. But what you are doing is you are cutting off both this government and future governments from the ability to use hydro as a public policy tool in an area that's really essential, which is around environmental policies and around trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And it's a major loss in terms of policy flexibility as well.
So who stands to gain from a potential privatization bid?
Well, clearly the people who stand to gain is Bay Street. And that is because they're a huge, this is going to be a very big, very complex transaction. And there's huge amounts of money to be made by the banks, by the brokerage firms, by the consultants, by lawyers, in terms of structuring this kind of a deal. There was a Globe and Mail article that said the last failed round of privatization resulted in more than $100 million of fees, and that was in 2002. Now, the government has talked about how it's going to limit the fees and how it's going to control the fees and how it will demand that people have actually lower fees than is the market standard, but there is still going to be a huge transfer of funds from Ontario Hydro's owners, which are the people of Ontario, to Bay Street firms to pay for this privatization.
And on the other side, who's going to lose? What's been the track record of these kinds of energy privatizations, especially the sort of like Hydro one, the sort of consumer facing arm of the power system?
So we don't have like an enormous amount of evidence. But what we do see is we see that there's a whole bunch of ways in which it will probably increase the costs of electricity. So that likely privatization results in that increase in the experience. And because private operators have higher costs than government, for example, they have higher borrowing costs, that this will increase the cost of electricity. There's been some coyness from the privatization panel by saying, "Oh, this will not have any of an MP. This will not increase rates because rates are regulated." But rates are really regulated in Ontario on a cost pass through basis. So if, for example, legitimately, because the private sector does in fact have to, it's more expensive to borrow money as private sector rather than the public sector, those costs will be passed along.
That was Sheila Block, senior economist at CCPA Ontario, talking about the impending and highly unpopular privatization of Hydro One. That's all for this week. Talk to you again in 2 weeks. Until then.